Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say Richard Ellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them. Okay.
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
I don't remember exactly how it ended, Mr. Ward. I was so mad. I'd loved the guy for so long, and I probably still loved him a little bit, but I was so mad. And I don't remember how it ended. I left.
That voice you just heard was Chris Wilson, an old buddy of Alec Murdoch, who had to take the stand today for the state. He's also an attorney in South Carolina. I'm Ann Emerson. I am here with our exclusive legal analyst, South Carolina's former Attorney General Charlie Condon. I'm here with our executive producer of the podcast, Drew Tripp, and the master of controls back here, Maxwell Harrison, yes. Our chief photographer. We had a lot happen today, and it was something that some of us haven't seen in a courtroom before, mm-hmm. but there's obviously so much to unpack, both in with the jury and without. A lot of stuff hadn't been sort of settled yet. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, let me, if I could set the stage maybe procedurally, because that clip of Attorney Wilson, he was testifying what's called in camera. And so what's going on right now is that the state of South Carolina wants to introduce evidence. And there's a great Tara. From her reporting duties.
That's right.
Tara's walking in.
When you hear the door open around, what is it, 7:25, we've got Tara Jabora and Maxwell Harrison walking in at the same time. But go ahead, Charlie. Talk to us about what...
And to the point what I was trying to make, and just so people would understand what's happening, is the state of South Carolina is trying to introduce evidence of other crimes for which the defendant's not on trial. And normally that's foreboding. You can't do it. But there are exceptions to that, and there are several exceptions that are being debated. And by the way, we have really good lawyers, in my opinion, on both sides, a really good judge. There are going to be some fascinating legal arguments to me. Some might find them boring, but there are going to be some really good arguments tomorrow morning at 9:30. But what's going on is the judge first says, all right, let me hear in camera, meaning outside the presence of the jury, what you have, because I have to establish that you meet the evidentiary standard if it is admissible. And he signaled to me quite clearly he's going to allow almost all of this in, I believe, if not most of it.
And we're talking about all this financial fraud allegations.
From the bank, from the law firm, from the relative to the boat wreck. They're just...
Got it.
States, though, made it very clear. They're not trying to prove 99 financial crimes, but they want to put in evidence of this because they do believe that this case is one of financial white-collar crime turning into blood-red, if you will, crimes. The financial crimes are leading to the violent crimes that he's accused of committing. So anyhow, we're having this hearing in camera outside the presence of the jury so the judge could establish that it's clear and convincing evidence. That's the standard. And I thought he very cleverly, at the end of the day, said, I don't need to really hear everyone testify as to every bit of evidence. I'm satisfied. He made specific rulings. He was satisfied about law firm theft. Mm-hmm. The Gloria Satterfield, he's going to be satisfied with the confession and judgment. He sped things up. So I think we're going to have arguments tomorrow, but 2 hours at most of all this inclusive in-camera testimony. Attorney Tinsley can't be there tomorrow, so I think he's going to testify Monday. But my expectation
is... For the boat case. You're talking about the boat case. Yeah.
My expectation is the in-camera is going to end, and we'll get the good live testimony at 11:30. So that's where we are procedurally.
Well, that's fantastic, Charlie. It really helps us a lot to understand what's going on, because when I was sort of looking at it from a layman's perspective, it was like a trial within a trial. We have a jury for part of it, and we're going to talk about the part that the jury actually listened to today, which was not a whole lot.
No, it was quick.
It was not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It was also fragmented, mm-hmm. I noticed, during the day. So there was a part with the jury, there was a part without the jury. And so let's talk about one of the first things the jury actually heard before they went into this in-camera testimony. New word for me. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So there was a Snapchat representative. And Drew, why do you think that they brought in a Snapchat representative?
It's curing, I think, is the term for it. But Charlie can give better explanation of that, but they've got to not only tell you what time it is, they've also got to tell you how to make the watch to authenticate with their witnesses, and they've just got to bring someone in mm-hmm. to say, yeah, this video that you see here was posted on Snapchat, and it was posted at X time and on Y date, and it's just part of it.
Just has to happen.
Yeah.
So Heidi Glore was the woman who came in for
that
the
was her name. I see.
Heidi Glore came in for as a Snapchat representative, and she basically told us what time this video was taken. And we've seen this video. This is the video of Alec Murdoch with Paul Murdoch out on the farm, Moselle. Trying to get a tree to be standing back up. But the thing that's so important about this is the timeline that it sets, which is that she could confirm that video was actually taken at 7:38 p.m. on June 7th, the night of the double murders.
Wow.
An hour and 11 minutes before
the murder. To me, that was really strong circumstantial evidence, because he was wearing what I would describe out there on the farm, business casual, right? He had on nice long pants and a nice shirt and nice casual shoes. It's not the sort of farm wear you might have expected if he was out there sort of working around.
Well, and he wasn't wearing the white T-shirt and green khaki shorts.
So where did the clothing go, right? That's the state's,
That's a huge question.
And it's a short time frame.
And the state is yet to address those clothes, yet to even bring them up. Mm-hmm. But they brought them up to, it was brought up today with another witness we mm-hmm. heard from, Katie McAllister, a SLED agent, who came and said she searched the house with 20 to 25 people there, by the way, who were not the victims or not law enforcement agents. They were friends and family at the Moselle house the day after this afternoon,
yeah. Was that the time frame?
Mid-morning mm-hmm. afternoon. I'm not 100% sure, but she apparently searched the house with John Marvin Murdoch and mm-hmm. Attorney Danny Henderson in tow, and went room to room, didn't find any guns, didn't find any evidence of bloody clothes, didn't find anything like that. Says she looked in the bathtubs, couldn't find any evidence of blood where anybody had, to the naked eye, evidence of blood where anybody had tried to rinse themselves off or wash off. I thought Dick Harpootlian seized on that, and he's like, you know, you can do forensic testing on things like showers mm-hmm. and look for trace evidence of blood.
That's
and
what liminal is, right?
Yeah, to your evidence, or to your knowledge, did anybody mm-hmm. ever do that? And I think she answered no.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
True.
Yeah, and that's what Dick's trying to do. The defense is trying mm-hmm. to poke holes.
Mm-hmm. And that was effective, I thought.
Well, so there was another part that the jury was in for, and we want to explain that as well, because that's going to play a role in this, we think. Mm-hmm. Dylan Hightower was there. Mm-hmm. He was coming out of one of our, the 14th Circuit.
Yeah, he's a criminal investigator, class one officer, 14th Judicial Circuit investigator. And they had the case initially. They weren't recused, as I understand at that point. It was a local prosecutor's case, even though I think we need to point this out, not here to, I have a lot of respect for Duffy Stone, I think he's terrific, but at that point in time, correct me if I'm wrong, that's why I think they all thought that he was a victim and not a suspect, really. But at that point in time, the defendant was a volunteer assistant solicitor for him, right?
Right. Yeah. He was a volunteer prosecutor, for sure. Mm-hmm. And so he had been working in the 14th Circuit, and that, you know, Dylan Hightower came in and was actually ended up being the person who was able to take Maggie's phone, look at Maggie's phone after she was murdered. And no, I'm sorry, it was Alex's phone. It was Alex. He was looking at both of the phones, but Alex's phone is the one that was the big concern. There were deleted calls off of that phone. How many phone calls were deleted? Did you see?
If I remember correctly, I heard 73.
That's what I heard, too.
I believe we had the soundbite pulled up. Max, if you're ready to...
From the extraction or from the actual device to the phone logs that I saw on the call detail records provided from Verizon. On the date in question on June 7th, I only saw two FaceTime calls on the phone extraction, and I saw a series of around 73 phone calls on the Verizon call detail record.
Okay. And what did that tell you when you saw that that missing information?
It could be a multitude of things. They were either removed by the user or the one responsible for using the device. It could have overlapped from the call log history. It could have been a series of things.
Okay, so that was what Dylan Hightower was talking about. He was talking specifically about Alec Murdoch's phone. There was this question earlier in testimony over the past couple of days about missing calls, that it was very strange that between May 30th and June 7th that there were just a few FaceTime calls that had been recorded. And now we're learning, because of Verizon records, there were 73 calls deleted during that period. Right. We don't know. They kind of left that for us, right?
Well, yeah,
kind of a cliffhanger again.
Yeah, and there were two explanations. One was active deletion by the user.
Right.
And the other explanation was, if you have a lot of calls, apparently, as I understand what he was testifying to, is that the calls themselves, that recordation of that could be erased by other means. But it looks suspicious. It did.
Well, it was, you know, he was saying, I think if a bunch of calls were coming in, it could
fall off.
Delete some.
It would fall off.
Let's put ourselves in the shoes of jurors here. The reasonable doubt. How many, you can pull up your phone right now. And yes, it's true that after a certain amount of time, certain number of calls, certain number of years, your phone call log will just automatically start deleting from the back.
Right.
It doesn't wipe all of itself out for and start from the top when that happens. So a reasonable doubt. What's the more plausible explanation?
Yeah,
manually deleted, which we heard the forensic expert testify to yesterday. It's like the most logical solution here is that those phone calls were manually deleted. And why were they manually deleted?
Yeah, and you know, hold that thought. One thing that just occurred to me, too, what might have been happening with Solicitor Stone, too, at that point in time, as I recall, the sheriff of Colleton called in Sled. And so he recused local law enforcement.
Right.
So Sled's coming in. So Solicitor Stone and his investigator may have thought, well, I'll just simply assist Sled, who's a statewide agency.
Sure.
And that would handle any sort of appearance of conflict or actual conflict. But it wasn't until months later, right, until the Attorney General was
August 11th was when the letter went, from what I remember, that Duffy Stone sent it to A.G. Wilson and said, we need to...
But it wouldn't make sense. You're trying to help out, and you've got Sled coming in, a statewide agency. That could cover the appearance of conflict or actual conflict. So I think that makes lots of sense on an emergency basis, because you've got a major crime happening in your circuit. You want to do the best job possible for your citizens.
So we had yet to get inklings into what was the shoe to drop that got Duffy Stone to recuse himself and recuse his office. And we've gotten a little bit more of that, I think, through this trial. I believe that's around that time that third interview would have occurred with Alec Murdoch. And by that point, they would have had the phones unlocked, done the initial unlocking.
Mm-hmm.
Not Paul's.
That took
a long time to get Paul's. But maybe that lends a little bit more insight. And I think what it ended up coming down to was Duffy's explanation for his office was it wasn't abundantly clear to begin with that Alec was a suspect and that we needed to recuse ourselves. And there's been a lot of back and forth on that. You could, I think there's valid arguments all around as they should have backed off from the beginning,
right,
and cut ties from the beginning. But at the same time, they didn't. We're there. That happened. They didn't. Talking more about Dylan Hightower, just to give some of his bona fides, his credentials. He said in court, you know, it's not uncommon for me as the lead of the criminal investigation unit for the 14th Circuit to go to murder scenes. And I know in other court cases I've covered, Dylan has been there, and he specifically has testified about what he testified today. He specializes. He can extract phone data, like we, not to the extent that SLED expert, forensic expert, did, and we discussed in depth over the last 2 days prior to this. But Dylan Hightower has the ability to extract that phone data, and he is a specialist in phone cell tower history and location via triangulation of cell phone towers.
Yeah.
Your phone signal bounces off towers, and they can pretty closely... Yeah.
They needed him.
Yeah, yes. They needed him there.
They needed him there.
That was his job. And one thing we didn't also discuss... So he was the specialist. He was the local specialist for being able to track down somebody's call history and be able to fast track a call history from Verizon, so to speak, and compare notes on what's on the phone versus what's on the, because you can't delete what Verizon has. The other thing that we didn't really discuss with him is he also is the one who found Maggie's phone. And he did so. This was, I don't know if this is going to end up being important or just one of those things where two people just weren't on the same page. Hightower testified he found Maggie's phone. They didn't do anything with it, and they immediately put it into airplane mode and put it into evidence. Then along comes Katie McAllister from SLED right after him and says, no, actually, I was on the phone, or no, one of my agents was on the phone with Alec or somebody back at Moselle, and they got the code from Alec Murdoch, and I opened the phone with the code, and then we put it into evidence after we put it into airplane mode. So there was a discrepancy there. Hightower said nobody opened that phone, and they didn't need to, because with Maggie's cell phone, the model of iPhone she had, you can just open it and put it into airplane mode without ever unlocking it.
Right.
Sure.
And then right after him comes McAllister and says, no, actually, I did unlock the phone. And so that, again, that was a big point they were trying to make. Are you sure nobody accessed this phone after the fact? And I don't know if it'll be a big deal the way...
You just want everybody on the same page when you're actually... testifying, right? You don't want to hear from two expert witnesses that were on the scene.
They weren't expert witnesses.
Or witnesses, or part of the law enforcement witnesses.
True.
Let's go to what happened when the jury was out. So we had in camera with...
Can I tap out here? You guys just take over the rest of the show? Because I...
Why is that? No.
This was he's taxing. This
oh was taxing. Wow! I found it just so riveting. I really did.
Good.
Okay. I can't believe that. What do you mean? You had set the scene here. You had the office manager. I mean, the lady who
CFO.
Jeannie
Secondjar.
And she was very bright and terrific witness, I thought, for the state. They ran her through just a tremendous amount of financial crimes, and she's confronting Alec, and he snarled at her, right? Did I hear that? I mean,
well, let's play the clip. Now, before we do, I gotta say, so Jeannie Secondjar, this is actually the morning, we think is late morning, something like
first
that.
Thing, no, first thing in the morning. She said it was earlier than normal. She went up to Alex's office.
Yeah, you were listening to every last sound bite.
Again, I'm not complaining. Look at my notes from today in that live blog we did.
This is the day of the murder, right?
Yes.
This is the day of the murder.
I mean, wow.
It's not this.
What are you getting? You're getting spoiled on this trial. This is a great moment.
I'll get to my point after we play the sound bite of Jeannie Secondjar.
Jeannie Secondjar, well, we'll go ahead and play it. Go ahead.
Came up and said, what do you need now? And gave me a very dirty look, not a look that I'd ever received from Alec, from just kind of frustrated with me look.
Okay, so to set that up, Jeannie Secondjar has gone in to talk to Murdoch about missing money, missing fees, and she wants to know what's going on. And Alec Murdoch, she says, has always been this incredibly gracious sort of...
Charming.
They've known each other 40 years.
They've known each other since high school. She's worked in this firm for 20 years. She's worked her way up all the way to CFO.
And she's related by a marriage to his banker, right?
Of course, yes. That's exactly right. Her sister married Russell Lafitte, which is the federal trial that Drew knows all about as well.
And the defendant's a banker, right?
So this is what's going on. So Jeannie looks at him and, has to confront him. And all of a sudden, she says he sort of turned on her and snarled.
Mm-hmm. And we also have, during this whole thing, that's why I found this so riveting, his father's dying, right? Who I knew well, Randy Murdoch. Right? I called him Randy. People now, I guess, he morphed into Randolph. But he's in the process of really being ill, right? And so the meeting's kind of broken up, right, relative to a phone call.
Exactly.
With his
extraordinary timing, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I mean...
you couldn't write this in a screenplay, could you? Mm-hmm. Like, literally, Jeannie goes to finally kind of works up to go in, closes the door, tells Alec, we got a problem. There's money missing. This is the first time he's actually been confronted by his law firm.
Yeah.
And the phone rings, and it's about his dad, and his dad's dying. He's on his deathbed in the hospital.
And then meeting over.
Meeting over, and already.
Right. And did you catch later in the day that he called her? Remember, she testified about that. He called her later in the day asking about his 401k about 4 or 5 o'clock.
Yep.
Now, that is a phone call, too, that I thought was...
important.
Yes. And so he, the state's theory is that he committed these horrendous murders to take attention off of his misdeeds, financial misdeeds, and to push things off. And, if you step back from this, I know that I've felt that he was, when I heard about it, I felt that he was a victim. I'm sure the local officials did.
Sure.
I'm certain Solicitor Stone's office and his investigators did. You wouldn't, I mean, they weren't thinking the unthinkable, that he would kill his family.
I don't think.
And it makes sense.
It
makes sense to me.
It is the unthinkable, right?
So that's why the state's trying so hard to get in evidence to explain. And I don't know how to put this as politely, but, we know it's relatively, unfortunately, it's not unheard of for a husband to kill a wife. I mean, that is not something, but for a father who's got a great relationship with a son to murder his own son. So I do think the state needs to put into some sort of understanding in human nature how you could get to this point. That's why I think they're trying really hard to understand the whole world of Alec Murdoch
the
caving
pressures.
In. It's like a 10-year period of time, and this isn't just one isolated act. It isn't because he's being confronted by missing 192,000 or whatever the figure was, or 792. It's this entire other world. He's living a life that is not known to others. Of course, he's thrown in some opioid addiction, but the financials are so important to the state.
Well, and just to be very clear for everyone who did not watch what we were watching all day, this was part of the in-camera, which is what Charlie's talking about, this time when the jury is taken back to the jury room. We're allowed to be in there. Court TV was there, so you were able to see the live stream of what was going on, but the jury is not listening to this. They are not privy to this testimony right now of Jeannie Seckinger. Chances are, if it's going to go through, we're going to hear it again, right?
Yep.
Oh, no, what you're going to hear, I used to like in camera when I was prosecuting, because you had a trial run, and you try and do it very quickly so the judge doesn't get mad at you for taking too much time. So you go boom, boom. You notice how you did a lot of leading questions, get right to it. But you get in a good rhythm with your witnesses. And I do think the one possible problem you might have, I think for the law firm witness, she's going to be great. But Chris Wilson has so much emotion that I would think he'd want that. But I think he'll do it again probably in front of the jury. And so I think we're going to see much more extended direct examinations by the state of these witnesses. And so, I was riveted. And Chris Wilson, now that had to be interesting, wouldn't you say, Drew, no?
Yes.
Okay.
Let me explain myself, is why.
Okay, good. I'm feeling better about this now.
Yeah.
It was taxing to try and, because I felt very much that I needed to, as I was tracking this, as close to verbatim as possible and as in-depth as
Genie Sekinger.
Because we had the background. We had the background to know. Genie Sekinger dropped this bomb two months ago in the Alec Murdoch, Russell Lafitte trial. That's when we first learned about her confronting Murdoch the morning of the murders.
But and that was the federal trial of Russell Lafitte.
That federal trial was, we have not had.
So she testified. Okay, got it.
We weren't allowed to, it was much harder to keep up with the ins and outs. And we got a much more in-depth of the ins and outs of how it all played out. And it's very, 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 very important to get, I thought, to get Jeannie's full story taken down.
Right.
And I thought the same with Chris Wilson. Yeah. And after doing that all day.
So I think then, we exhausted
it. I see. He did have mind-numbing detail on how all that money. And it was.
Right.
To your point earlier, it's chaos, right? I mean, he creates chaos, the defendant, with all his friends and family. And
it was duck and dive. And we've heard it over and over again. It's like, oh, yeah, the money's coming in. Oh, you haven't seen the check yet. Oh, well, where's the check? So we've heard all of these stories about how Alec used his larger than life personality to play a role in what the state alleges he did on these financial crimes. I want to play something from the defense because the defense wasn't quiet today. They were working hard as well, trying to gauge how much they really needed to stop. I think that the point that they're trying to get to is here. Let's hear what Jim Griffin had to say about the boat case, and when I think this is basically at the beginning of why he's trying to disconnect this murder trial from the financial fraud.
And the concern was hiding fees from the civil discovery in the boating case.
Yes, at that point in time it was.
And that wasn't, and at that point in time no one was saying that they thought he was stealing from the firm, but that he was sheltering money from being disclosed.
That was the opinion, yes.
So he's trying to water it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's trying to say, look, things were not that bad for Alec. He had ways to deal with this. Why in the world would he try and distract from financial crimes at this point and have this execution-style, brutal double murder of his youngest son and his wife of more than two decades. It is really hard to believe.
And I do think that was a really good way to frame it for the judge. We're in camera now. This is for the judge.
That was in camera, yes.
And this is for Judge Newman to say, don't let all this in because it really doesn't make any sense. And it's really unfair to my client for you to do so. I thought that was really effective to try and get Judge Newman to possibly change. I don't think he will, but maybe then to limit his ruling. So we'll know tomorrow, but I think where we're headed with this is he doesn't want the state to spend weeks on this, but he's going to allow them to present evidence of some financial crimes, and we'll see the extent of that tomorrow.
And we've got one more clip to play. I want to set it up about Chris Wilson, because that was, as you said, incredibly emotional testimony. And let's go ahead and listen to this clip with Chris Wilson. Chris Wilson came in to testify once again in camera. Jury is not there. You heard it at the very top of the show, and you're going to hear it at the end. And really, this clip is something that I think they really wanted. Well, it's what they really wanted the judge to hear, how devastating this really was to his personal relationships.
I mean, the first thing I ask him is, you know, Alec, what the H is going on here? You know, what is going on? And have you done something else to me or that involves me that I don't know about? Because I know about this and I've got to deal with this, but is there something else you've done that I don't know about that I need to be concerned with?
Tell me how this is going to play a role in what the jury hears. If the jury is allowed to hear Chris Wilson talk. Once again, Chris Wilson, attorney, old friend of Alex, and got caught up in some of these financial fraud allegations, and he looks devastated.
Yes, and
weeping on the.
Yes, I mean he really did show emotion. I expect that we'll see that in front of the jury maybe times two. We'll see, but Well, where we left it was, that was the day of the botched. Really, if you wrote this, it's almost getting to the point now where I'm hard thinking, am I really hearing all this? But this is the day of the botched assisted suicide, where he confronts them. I can just see the scene here. It's on his parents' porch, right, in Alameda.
Right.
He said they had a heart-to-heart and used that language, and then he left. And then he heard later that night, right?
He heard within a couple hours.
Yeah, and that he didn't think it was any sort of thing other than Alex trying to kill himself, literally trying to kill himself, as
and
I understood it.
He didn't stop. He kept driving.
Right.
That was the more powerful thing to me, even than what we just heard right there, is Chris gets a phone call. He's up the road a little way. He stops to get lunch. He's on the way back to his home in Columbia. He gets a call that Alex has been shot on the side of the road, and he's like, I'm going to keep driving.
Yeah, and by the way, this your viewers might find this interesting. I did. You know, you had Mr. Gunn testify from Forge Consulting, who I recognized him. I had to know his dad, and it was his dad's terrific person named Eddie Gunn. But anyhow, what point of all that you had, and you had Attorney Wilson testify, but the law firm, the amount of legal talent that's coming into Walterboro, South Carolina. So Pete Strom's firm was basically there representing these folks. Known Pete for years. His dad used to be head of SLED, Picari Seller. So you had these very prominent attorneys come in that are representing people in all of this. And I just, from a legal standpoint, again, we do have, I think, the trial of the century going. And the supporting cast is very impressive.
Well, we are going to wrap it up for today because we probably need to. We're going to have a lot more tomorrow to yes. unpack. And as far as tomorrow goes, what's the one thing that we need to be looking for? Give me...
Judge's ruling is key. And then we'll launch into, I think, the same type testimony, probably the same witnesses, and it should be compelling.
And will it be in front of the jury?
Yeah, yes. And you'll see a really different approach from the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be fascinated how the defense approaches this, probably along the lines of, you're not trying to say this all happened because of financial crimes, are you? Something along those lines.
Sure. And they'll keep going. Well, I'm Ann Emerson, Charlie Condon, Drew Tritt, Max Harrison. Drew, do you have something to say? I don't want to leave you out.
Let's hear it.
I'm sorry. He looked at me and he kind of, you can't see him, of course. He's the voice of God over here. But he looks at me and kind of puts his arm out like, stop.
The visual, the comparison, the metaphor of a heavyweight fight that is coming more into focus for me between Jim Griffin and Creighton Waters. And that's the one thing I think more than anything we've noticed the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
This was the Dick Harpootlian show for a while, and it is when it comes to the legal arguments.
That's an interesting point because I know Jim's sort of taken over the...
Jim has, and this is to go full circle on my point, where it got really taxing to me today is we kept hearing the same thing over and over again. And it was Jim Griffin and Creighton Waters throwing the same haymaker punches over and over again. And we made no headway.
Yeah.
We made no headway. And that the point being how implausible and absurd it is to make the leap from financial troubles to double murder of your wife and son. Mm-hmm. And Creighton Waters' point of it is all connected. It is all connected, and I can show you it's all connected. And we,
and by the way, to complete your thought, I think we have a heavyweight judge. Judge Newman, we'll have these intense legal arguments, and he'll say in just this wonderful voice, sustained, overruled. His demeanor is just fantastic.
It really is. It really is. It's going to go down as one of the most even keel judges we've seen under this kind of pressure. Well, back to saying goodbye. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks so much.